They signed up like other Australians once they were allowed to serve. They fought and died in the ranks. But when the Aboriginal soldiers of the AIF came home, they were not greeted as heroes, nor did they get the help white soldiers were given to settle back into civilian life. Emeritus Professor John Maynard, a Warumi man from Port Stephens in New South Wales, argues that their experience in the war played a crucial role in the rise of organised Aboriginal political activism in the 1920s. John has been on this show often. He's a historian, formerly at Newcastle University, and has written more than a dozen books, many charting the political activism of his people. He's contributed a chapter to a new book just published for this Anzac Day. It's called Challenging Anzac Stories That Don't Fit the Legend. His chapter is called Fighting on the Western Front and Returning Home to Fight Again. John joins me now.
Pleasure, David.
John, first shock for me. Aboriginal men were not allowed to enlist. Why?
Yes, the Defence Act was in, and they brought that in from when the war came up, that coloured men or Aboriginal men were to be prevented from enlisting, and that was also with Asian men. Any person of colour was not allowed to enlist. That changed, of course, in 1917 with the massive losses on the Western Front, and then suddenly Aboriginal people were encouraged to join. But I must say that, you know, from the start of the war all the way through to 1917, Aboriginal people still found a way to get in and enlist. In some instances, there were people to support them. You know, even the enlisting officer, you know, just cast a blind eye to them going through, and some enlisted. So that has to be said. But yeah, it's a shock that Aboriginal people were standing up and volunteering, you know, in the First World War, as Aboriginal men had done in the Boer War, and as Aboriginal men and women since have, defended Australia in every conflict all the way through to Afghanistan and Iraq.
Was the idea back then, the First World War, that a white AIF would fight better?
Yeah, I'm sure that was ingrained in the thinking of the day, because we had the White Australia policy come through, and I mean racism was rampant, you know, and the blocking of Aboriginal people in so many areas, you know, and I have to say that the pressures on Aboriginal people, certainly in the turn into the 20th century, began to mount, and that escalated through into the First World War. And there's a history here that a lot of people don't know, and I'm not just talking about non-Indigenous people, but also Aboriginal people, that from the mid-19th century through to 1910, in New South Wales I'm talking about here, Aboriginal people regained 27,000 acres of prime land. And I'm not talking out in the west, in the middle of nowhere. I'm talking prime land on the south coast and prime land on the north coast. And Aboriginal people gained 20, 30, 40, even upwards of acres of land. And all on their traditional country. If it was Warramai or if it was Dungudi or Wiradjuri or whoever it was, they were rightened to regain land in their traditional country. And this is a really important thing to consider, because Aboriginal people prospered on that land. Some of these petitions to the government were written by self-educated Aboriginal people, and others were given support by non-Indigenous supporters to write in. And in that particular time period, there was no protection board. There was nobody overseeing Aboriginal lives like they did from the, you know, 1910, particularly with the protection board. So Aboriginal people had a lot more freedom. And on this land, the police officer was sent out to examine the land that Aboriginal people had petitioned for. And these lie in the archives. And the police officer's account comes back and says, it's heavily timbered, worthless scrub. Give it to them. Land's granted to Aboriginal people. 12 months later, the same police officer comes in with a report. It's all been cleared. They've fenced it. They've got crops. They've got livestock. They've built homesteads. And this was a period Aboriginal people really prospered on. But the impact against that is during the First World War. So from that time on, there was white pressure groups wanting the Aboriginal land, and also the soldier resettlement scheme come in for returning soldiers, you know, from the Western Front.
Let's get to that. Let's get to that in a second after we've had a look at what the actual conditions were for those Aboriginal men who signed up with the AIF. Did any go into the Navy? Any go into the Air Force? Do you know?
No, not in the First World War,
right.
David, but certainly,
So in the First World War, we're talking about the Army.
Yeah.
And once they went in, were they treated as equals?
Look, there are accounts of, you know, that camaraderie between Aboriginal soldiers and non-Indigenous soldiers, but there's also incredible accounts of racism that was levelled at Aboriginal soldiers, you know, and the racism come through that they were given more detention, their pay was cut, you know, all of this sort of stuff was really mounting up and is really in the records. And you can imagine what that is like, you know, like the impact of you're fighting for your country, you've put your life on the line, and you're here in the trenches with others who are, you know, inflicting racism upon you. And I mean, the anger that was boiling up in that really sort of reacted in quite a number of Aboriginal soldiers. They found that really difficult to deal with.
How many Aboriginal men do you think enlisted in the AIF for the First World War?
We know now, though, I was on a major project with Mick Dodson, which included the Australian Defence, Veterans Affairs and the War Memorial for 4 years. And we concluded after that project that over 1,000 Aboriginal men had enlisted and fought in the First World War.
Do you know how many died?
I couldn't say offhand, but I could get that number for you. But quite a few, David. There were several that died in Gallipoli, and of course there was massive losses on the Western Front for, you know, all Australian servicemen and Aboriginal men included in those numbers.
Is there any record of Aboriginal men from different parts of Australia meeting up inside the army?
Oh, yes, there were, most certainly. You had people from New South Wales and Queensland and South Australia and Victoria, and they certainly come into contact with other Aboriginal servicemen during their time.
Is this what you see as one of the reasons that they became so politically conscious after the war was over?
That certainly was. It was the tearing away of those independent Aboriginal farms that was going on while they were overseas, and also the escalation by the Protection Board of tearing Aboriginal kids away from their families. And you had quite a number of these Aboriginal servicemen return home after the war to find that their children had been removed from their wives' care and placed into institutions. Now, can you imagine what that would have done, you know, to your way of thinking and the anger that would have been bubbling up, and that you weren't afforded the same sort of respect as non-Indigenous soldiers had fought in World War One?
John, Jesus Christ. Let's get to that in a second. A few more things before the war ends.
Yep.
Were Aboriginal men taken prisoner?
Yes.
What do we know of them?
Yes, we know there's one very high-profile one, Douglas Grant, that was taken by the Germans on the Western Front, and he was imprisoned in Germany. And as I said, a very high-profile individual. Grant was adopted as a baby by Robert Grant, a taxidermist with the Australian Museum in Sydney, who had been in Queensland collecting, you know, items for the museum, and there was a major massacre of Aboriginal people. And in the early reports, it said, two Aboriginal groups had wiped each other out and the baby was the only survivor, and Robert Grant brought the baby back to Sydney. But as we later discovered, it was a vigilante group and native police who committed the massacre and wiped out two Aboriginal groups. But Douglas finished up adopted by Robert Grant and his wife, and was was raised with their other two children in Sydney and Annandale, had a really good education, finished up
at Scots College. Yeah, there are photographs of him in a kilt.
Yeah, as a draftsman as well with Mort's in Sydney. And he also worked for the White family at Beltrees in the Hunter Valley as a wool classer.
That I didn't know.
Yeah, yes, yes. And that's where he enlisted first off with some of his fellow workers at Beltrees. And he was at the Singleton Army Barracks, and they said that he'd hit the running target 100 times in succession with his rifle shooting, and he was a really good horseman. But then when he came to Sydney, he was knocked back. You know, so he, his friends who he'd listed with went on, and he was told he couldn't go. But of course, with the contacts that he had, that was overruled, and he was on the next boat. So he finished up over there. But the time in the prisoner of war camp, he was the spokesperson for all the prisoners, white Indian soldiers who were imprisoned there, Muslim soldiers that were imprisoned there. He was the spokesman. He wrote all the letters, and he was the go-between in the prisoner of war camp, because the Germans recognised how intelligent he was and actually did brought in anthropologists and scientists to make studies of him.
To study his brain, because because he knew Shakespeare.
Yeah, yes, and played the bagpipes.
Indisputable attributes for any young man.
Yes.
But, John, the war ended and these men, the survivors of the Thousand, came home. And did they march in the marches through the cities of Australia to mark the return of the soldiers?
There are some evidence of some soldiers who marched, but many, I think, protested themselves. I mean, I know that Douglas Grant was dragged into a march later in life. One of his soldiers saw him standing in the crowd to the side and dragged him out. And he said, no, I've got nothing to do with this. And they dragged him in. And I know of other Aboriginal soldiers who protested against the marches. You know, in Western New South Wales, a member of the Flick family, he came up the street marching in the opposite direction to the march and marched straight through the middle of the march out the other end, you know, so, on his own. So I think that was a protest in itself to what he thought of military service.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to John Maynard, author, historian, about the chapter he has just contributed entitled Fighting on the Western Front and Returning Home to Fight Again. So you were saying, John, that many of these men returned home to find that they had not only lost their acres, but their children. Mm-hmm. And many who had not had acres before might have expected to get them, as white ex-servicemen were being given farms.
Yep.
What happened?
Aboriginal soldiers applied for it, and there's records there that they were told it doesn't apply to you, you're black. And one guy who was successful in his application then had to put in to develop it, that was knocked back, and the letter said, this is totally undesirable, he's a black man, and it shouldn't be awarded to him. So, you know, these were the barriers that were put in place of Aboriginal people. And as I said, you've put your life on the line. You've went overseas to defend your country. And I think that's an important thing. Yes, Aboriginal men went to enlist for pay and adventure, but they also went to make change to Australia, you know, for justice and recognition for Aboriginal people, citizenship, to be recognised, the Aboriginal people, families and communities to be recognised as a major part of this country. And all they got was a kick in the guts and a slap in the face.
John, have you been able to find any directive within the records of the public service that says Aboriginal returned soldiers are not to be given soldier settlement farms?
No, there is no official document that, you know, stopped the awarding of these, you know, soldier resettlement schemes to Aboriginal men. It was just done at that level, that local level where it's come through, and some administrator, for no other reason than I would say blatant racism, has knocked the entry back.
Did anyone contest it?
Not that I'm aware of, David.
They just rolled with it.
Well, they rolled with it, but very bitter about it, you know, and that's the reality with what came later with the rise in the 1920s of organised Aboriginal political activism for the first time.
Right. So how does that follow on from the war?
Yeah, well, again, you've got soldiers who have been over there and fought overseas and seen things from a world experience and seen the brutality of what these so-called civilised man is doing. And you've returned home to see as well that you haven't been awarded the recognition that you feel you should and your families and community should have been afforded. And now you are quite bitter about it. And as I said, the soldier resettlement scheme has been knocked back. There, we do know that six Aboriginal men did get, you know, land, but that's a 1,000 that enlisted, you know. So the only one of them finished up being able to go on with that land, but he didn't last on the land either. So you've got that bitterness that is built into the Aboriginal psyche after the war. And also the change after the war, there was a major, reshuffling of the world order. There were outbreaks in Egypt. There were outbreaks in India. People were clamouring for, you know, self-determination and rights following what had happened. These great empires were shown up for what they were, totally brutal things. And, you know, then people thought, this is a glimmer of hope. It's time for us to rise up now, speak up and speak out and demand a place in the world order. And that was very much the case in America and the United States, with the biggest black movement that's ever been seen in the US, led by Marcus Garvey, a West Indian who arrived in Harlem in New York in 1916 and established the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And interestingly enough, my grandfather, for one, and Tom Lacey and another Aboriginal man whose sons fought in the First World War, were wharf labourers. And Aboriginal wharf labourers on the Sydney docks were coming into contact with merchant sailors from overseas, black merchant sailors, African Americans, West Indians, Indians, Africans. And these people were bringing manifestos and newspapers, political newspapers, into Australia. You know, so this information began to germinate with Aboriginal people, and certainly my grandfather during that period realised that the racism and the prejudice and oppression that Aboriginal people were being subjected to and facing here in Australia wasn't just a localised thing, it was a globalised thing, and it needed to be recognised and fought in that context. And certainly my grandfather and Tom Lacey joined a chapter of Marcus Garvey's organisation that formed in Sydney in 1920 and was operational through to 1924.
But in Australia, we had the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association.
Yep.
Now, what were their aims?
Yep.
And what happened to that association?
Yep. The AAPA came into being after the Garvey movement collapsed in the US and the chapter here finished. And then the Aboriginal activists realised that we'd be better off fighting for it on our own space, you know, with an Aboriginal organisation. And the Australian Aboriginal Progressive Association formed in 1924 and really came to the forefront in 1925 when they held the first ever Aboriginal convention at St David's Church and Hall in Surry Hills in 1925. And they were front page news in the Sydney press. You know, my grandfather's inaugural address was covered in that media coverage. And he said, you know, at that particular point in time, the platform for Aboriginal people was to demand enough land for each and every Aboriginal family in the country. That was a national land rights agenda 100 years ago. They were a big headline banner, self-determination, Aborigines demand self-determination. That was 50 years before the Whitlam Labor government accredited with putting up self-determination as a Aboriginal policy in the 1970s. They demanded that the protection boards be abolished and be replaced by an all-Aboriginal board to run Aboriginal affairs in Australia. They wanted the practice of Aboriginal children being removed from their families and placed in institutions to cease, and Aboriginal family life to be protected. So these were the things at the very forefront. And, you know, my grandfather said, you know, again in the media coverage, we have overriding rights above all others in our land. I mean, that's a sovereignty statement, if you can Indeed. Ask for one, you know. And he said, again in that media coverage in 1925, we want to be in charge of our own destiny. So,
but was the AAPA successful in any of these aims?
Well, they gained massive coverage through the media, and they gained, in 6 months, they had 13 branches and 4 sub-branches formed across New South Wales. There was notifications of the AAPA in Queensland, Victoria and South Australia and right across New South Wales. They opened their own offices in Crown Street, Sydney. This was the move at this particular point in time. One old Aboriginal elder wrote into one of the papers and actually said, we want to hear more of the Freedom Club. We want them to come and visit us. You know, so they certainly gained incredible impact with Aboriginal people and communities.
And to what extent was this old soldiers leading?
Very, very much a major part of it. You know, Dick Johnson, First World War, and a very close friend of my grandfather, who was wounded on the Western Front and proudly wore the soldier's badge. He was the secretary of the AAPA. And Tom Lacey, the treasurer, Tom Lacey had 2 sons who were horribly treated in the First World War. And Tom Lacey was a very prominent Aboriginal fighter for justice. And so he was very much at the forefront of the organisation as well.
But it folded.
Yes, it folded, but they went on for 5 years. They held a second conference in Kempsey, and also in 1925. And this is an aspect of history that most people don't know, not just white fellas, but Aboriginal people. They held a 3-day conference in Kempsey at the Kempsey Showground. Over 700 Aboriginal people attended that 3-day conference. You know, that is an amazing number of people who were there, you know, to speak. And all the papers were written and delivered by Aboriginal people, some in Aboriginal language. The newspapers, the Macleay Argus and the Macleay Chronicle, gave high coverage to this particular conference, you know. And again, you would think of the coverage that they gained that, you know, governments, whether they were state or federal, would begin to take notice. And the AAPA were bombing letters through, you know, demanding that they were listened to. And certainly momentum was rolling. They held a 3rd conference in Grafton in 1926 and a 4th one in Lismore in 1927. But the mobilisation, the protection board were really alarmed, and they saw that as a threat to their own control, which had really ramped up. And Aboriginal people, you know, from 1910 on were being forced onto these more heavily controlled reserves where people had no say over their life, what they wore, what they ate, who they could marry, and certainly they couldn't leave these controlled missions and reserves. So there was a real backlash against that from the AAPA, but the Protection Board fought back, because the Protection Board, the chairperson of the New South Wales Aborigines Protection Board, was the New South Wales Police Commissioner.
Yes.
And my grandfather and the other activists like Dick Johnson and Tom Lacey and others garnered a lot of police attention, harassment, and, you know, continued harassment on the streets and off it. And basically hounded out of existence in 1929, which was covered in the Communist Manifesto newspaper. In 1931, they said the rank and file organisation set up by the Aborigines was smashed by the Protection Board, the police and the missionaries. So that's what happened at that particular point in time, sadly.
And the role of the Communist Party is the next chapter, which we won't be looking at today, because today we're looking at the role of the war. John, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Oh, pleasure, David. Absolute pleasure, mate.
I've been talking to Emeritus Professor John Maynard about the chapter he's contributed to the book Challenging Anzac Stories That Don't Fit the Legend. It's just been published by New South. This is Late Night Live.